Following the bunkhouses came the dining car. Its special feature was a long single table that ran the full length of the car. Here the men ate in shifts, 125 at a time. They had to eat quickly in order to make room for the next group so that everyone got back on the job on time. As a reporter for the New York Evening Post noted, it made for a lively scene, especially at breakfast, when the men had to first be awakened. "It is 5:30 and time for the hands to be waked up," the reporter wrote. "This is done by ringing a bell on the sleeping car until everyone turns out, and by giving the fellows under the car a smart kick, and by pelting the fellows in the tents on the top with bits of clay. In a very few minutes they are all out stretching and yawning. Another bell and they crowd in for breakfast. The table is lighted by hanging lamps, for it is yet hardly daylight. At intervals of about a yard are wooden buckets of coffee, great plates of bread, and platters of meat. There is no ceremony. Every man dips his cup into the buckets of coffee and sticks his own fork into whatever is nearest him. If a man has got enough and is through, he quietly puts one foot on the middle of the table and steps across. The dining car had another feature, one that was also part of each of the bunkhouses. In every handy spot there were long racks holding rifles. Between them, the bunkhouses and the dining car held more than 1,000 of these weapons, ready to be used in the event of an attack by Native Americans. The cars in the rest of the train housed kitchens, pantries, storerooms, engineers' offices, and carpenters' shops. One car served as casements' working quarters. As the train made its way across the plains, it was trailed by horse-drawn wagons carrying additional provisions and supplies. Bringing up the rear was a herd of some 500 cattle that would provide the crews their hefty meals. The creation of the construction train was a positive step in preparing the UP's crews for the enormous task that lay ahead of them. But even the most optimistic of the workers and their bosses knew that there would be extraordinary challenges. High on the list would be keeping the construction crews fully supplied with the tons of materials they needed to carry out their work. They would be crossing the plains for more than 1,500 miles, and with each passing mile they would be moving farther away from the sources of their vital supplies. To supply 1 mile of track with material and supplies required about 40 cars, Grenville Dodge would write. As on the plains, everything, rails, ties, bridging, fastenings, all railway supplies, fuel for locomotives and trains, and supplies for men and animals on the entire work, had to be transported from the Missouri River. Therefore, as we moved westward, every 100 miles added vastly to our transportation. Throughout the entire trek across the continent, one of the greatest concerns of the UP's men and officials was that they would lose their race against the CP by running out of supplies. There were other serious challenges as well. Weather was certainly one of them. In winter, the plains could be as bitterly cold and as blizzard-prone as the high mountains in which the Central Pacific was now struggling. In the summer, temperatures could reach over 100 degrees Fahrenheit, and remain there for days, sometimes weeks. And then there were the insects. As any of those in Casement's army who had spent time on the prairie knew all too well, the plains were swarming with the creatures. Among them were huge horseflies that tormented the workmen and drove their horses and mules to distraction. Worse yet were the billions of grasshoppers that periodically swept across the plains. On more than one occasion, they covered the tracks in such enormous numbers that even the heaviest locomotives would skid out of control. Of all the challenges the railroad crews faced, the one that put fear in the hearts of even the bravest workers was the threat of attack by Native people who lived along the railroad's route. The plains were home to millions of Native Americans: Sioux, Comanche, Arapaho, Pawnee, Paiute, Cheyenne, Kiowa, and other nations. Mounted on horseback, these Plains Indians were regarded by American Army officers as the best light cavalry in the world. For generations, they had resisted white encroachment into their lands. Now the appearance of thousands of railroad workers and the portent of what the tracks they were laying would mean represented the greatest intrusion they had ever faced. The coming of the railroad would leave the world of the West forever changed. It would bring more and more European-American settlers to the plains, resulting in forced removals, bloodshed, legal battles, and ultimately, the destruction of the Plains Indians' way of life. A linchpin of this destruction, and symbol of it, was the fate of the North American buffalo. As late as the mid-1800s, tens of millions of buffalo roamed the American plains. They were so numerous that just one herd could stretch for 25 miles. The buffalo were at the heart of the Plains Indians' existence. They had built their cultures, communities, and way of life around the animals, and depended on the many products they derived from them for food, clothing, tools, and shelter. The presence of the buffalo, however, posed a problem for the transcontinental railroad workers. The huge animals not only blocked the path of the rails, they also seriously damaged the tracks once they'd been laid. Killing off as many buffalo as possible became a high priority among those intent on driving the rails across the plains. And the millions of settlers who would follow in the railroad's wake would only deepen the threat to the buffalo. The settlers would come to the plains to farm. They weren't interested in the buffalo except as an animal to be hunted for sport, and they had no objections to the eventual slaughter of the buffalo by hunters and sportsmen to the brink of extinction. The decimation of the buffalo herds was a tragedy to the Plains Indians. At a meeting with government officials, a Crow chief named Bear's Tooth spoke for his fellow leaders when he implored, "Achan, Achan, Achan! Father, 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 listen well. Your young men have gone on the path and have killed my game and my buffalo. They did not kill them to eat. They left them to rot where they fell. Father, were I to go to your country to kill your cattle, what would you say? Father, you talk about farming. I don't want to hear it. I was raised on buffalo and I love it. Since I was born, I was raised like your chiefs, to be strong, to move my camps when necessary, to roam over the prairie at will. Take pity upon us. I am tired of talking." Beartooth's words fell on deaf ears. The buffalo would be massacred as never before. With each mile of track laid, the Indians' ages-old ability to roam over the prairie at will would be dramatically diminished. But across the plains, the UP's army of workers marched. First came the surveyors, engineers, axemen, flagmen, and hunters, working hundreds of miles ahead of the rest. They blazed the way through terribly difficult, often dangerous country few white men had ever seen. Their job was to set the exact line where the graders could carve out their roadbeds and the track layers could set down their rails. Being at the vanguard of the construction army provided the adventure that many of the surveyors and those who accompanied them sought. They encountered acres of grass that grew more than 10 feet high. They came upon prairie dog villages that stretched for more than 10 miles. They came face to face with rock formations, the shapes of which defied description. But every mile they traveled carried the potential for danger. In the warm weather, a prairie fire moving across the grass-filled plains with the speed of a locomotive could erupt at any time, threatening anything in its path. One young surveyor called them a grand and appalling sight. In the winter months, the surveying crews were confronted with a different kind of danger. Temperatures on the plains dropped so low that on more than one occasion, surveyors had their fingers freeze tight onto their measuring instruments. In one of the most bizarre incidents of all, an entire surveying party had to flee for their lives when a herd of some 2,000 wild cattle suddenly appeared and stampeded through their tents. In one of his diary entries, young surveyor Arthur Ferguson noted that 6 of the surveying party had drowned, 1 had died as the result of a fall, and 45 had been killed by American Indians. Through it all, the surveyors and those who assisted them operated with one constant thought. Everything depended on them. The army of workers that followed would not be able to carry out its various tasks unless the surveyors did their job. Far behind the surveyors, but still as many as 3 miles ahead of the track layers, came the graders. Their job was to construct the roadbed upon which the tracks would be laid. It was one of the most demanding of all the construction tasks, particularly when carried out on the open plains under the blistering sun. Working with pickaxes, shovels, scrapers, wheelbarrows, dump carts, horses, and mules, the graders dug away all obstacles that stood in the way of their building the smoothest surface possible for the rails. Each roadbed they created had to be more than 2 feet above the ground so that it would not flood in storms. All this required digging tons of dirt by hand, removing it from the side of the roadbed and dumping it. The sight of hundreds of wheelbarrow-toting graders lined up waiting for their barrows to be filled with dirt was one of the greatest spectacles of the entire construction. Because the final grade had to be unerringly level, all the work of the grading crews was carried out under the watchful eyes of various types of grading bosses. The dumping boss, who had to have the best eyesight of all, pointed with his shovel to the exact spot where he wanted wheelbarrows full of dirt dumped. He then used his shovel to level off each mound of dirt. The supervisors, who constantly checked on the graders, were called walking bosses. They were specially selected for their ability to prod the men into working as hard and as quickly as they could. They were joined by the stable bosses, who were in charge of the hundreds of horses and mules, and of the men who drove the wagons that the animals pulled back and forth to the grading sites with equipment and supplies. Overseeing all the graders and their bosses was the man known as the boarding boss. He was held accountable for the entire grading operation. Well behind the grading crews came scores of sturdy horse-drawn wagons. Each of them was piled high with the heavy railroad ties that would be placed on top of the grade and upon which the tracks would be set in place. Once the ties were set down, wheeled flat cars, pulled by horses and often driven by the youngest members of Casement's army, drew up to where the ties had been placed. They were filled with rails and spikes. Each of the flat cars had rollers on their sides to facilitate the unloading of the heavy iron rails. The burly track layers would take up their positions, 5 to each rail on each side of the track. At the command, down, the track layers would lift a 500 to 700-pound rail onto each side of the ties. It was a task that required enormous strength. Yet so expert were the track layers at carrying out the job that more often than not they dropped the rails in almost perfect position. It was a sight that never failed to capture the attention of the newsmen who were on the scene. The crew chief calls out down in a tone that equals the forward to an army, a reporter for the Cincinnati Gazette wrote. Every 30 seconds there came that brave down, down on either side of the track. They were the pendulum beats of a mighty era. They marked the time of the march and its regulation beat. No sooner had each set of rails been set down than the gaugers stepped forward. Armed with their notched wooden gauges, they made certain that the rails were perfectly aligned to fit the locomotive wheels that would soon be racing upon them. Right behind them came the spikers, who used sledgehammers to pound long spikes through the rails and ties into the ground. 3 strokes to a spike, 10 spikes to a rail, 400 rails to a mile. Gazing on Casement's army as it began to make its march across the plains, Grenville Dodge shook his head in wonder. It was, he exclaimed, the best organized, best equipped, and best disciplined workforce I have ever seen.